I'd like to take a moment to let you all know about a new nonprofit organization started by my brother Craig. It's called Treats and Truth. They fill oversized brown lunch bags with snack items, chips, crackers, popcorn, cookies, etc. Also, a bottle of water, toothbrush, toothpaste, sanitary wipes, and most importantly, a small gospel tract book of John. No cigar? I'll have to talk to him about that. The bags are then hand-delivered to the homeless and people in need in and around the Los Angeles area. Let's help get this ministry off the ground. They're a 501c3 tax-exempt organization, so any and all donations are tax-deductible and greatly appreciated. Visit their website at treatsandtruth.org. Check out the show notes for the link. Also, please follow them on Facebook and Instagram. Thank you. Welcome to episode 78 of the Burning Bush Podcast, where we share the message of the Bible while enjoying a good cigar. Hope you're doing well. Glad you've joined me today. This week, we continue reading through Dr. Justin Bass's book, The Bedrock of Christianity, The Unalterable Facts of Jesus' Death and Resurrection. And I'm smoking the La Aroma de Cuba Immensa 5 3/4 by 60. So let's go on over to the La Roma de Cuba website and see what they have to say. The original La Roma de Cuba blend is drawn from a premium recipe of well-aged Nicaraguan binder and filler tobaccos, patiently assembled beneath a shimmering Connecticut broadleaf wrapper. A phenomenal medium-bodied profile of cocoa, cedar, molasses, and earth layers the palate with subtle distinction in several classic sizes. Indulge in a classic profile lauded as the summit where taste and value converge. And it is a medium strength. Country of origin is Nicaragua, and the wrapper is Connecticut broadleaf, one of my favorites. Tasting notes are cocoa, cedar, molasses, earth, and spice. And it won, it got included in the top 25 cigars of the year from Cigar Aficionado in 2004 and 2006. And the vitolas are Rothschild 5 by 50, Robusto 5 1/4 by 54, Corona 5 1/2 by 44, the Bellicoso 5 1/2 by 52, Immensa 5.75 by 60, the Monarch 6 by 52, Churchill 7 by 50, and the El Jefe 7 by 58. And oh, there's one more, Double Corona 7 1/2 by 54. And that is the La Roma de Cuba. Okay, so let's go ahead and get back into The Bedrock of Christianity by Dr. Justin Bass. The title of this week's section is, What Did They See? In 2000, when interviewed by news anchor Peter Jennings for his documentary, The Search for Jesus, agnostic New Testament scholar Paula Fredrickson said of the early Christians, I know in their own terms what they saw was the raised Jesus. That's what they say, and then all the historic evidence we have afterwards attests to their conviction that that's what they saw. I'm not saying that they really did see the raised Jesus. I wasn't there. I don't know what they saw, but I do know that as a historian, they must have seen something. They must have seen something. Besides Jesus rising from the dead, The two most prevalent answers today to the question, what did they see, are either that they had hallucinations or I don't know. I'll discuss the earliest apostolic proclamation, namely that the historical Jesus did rise from the dead, along with what I call the cautious agnostic approach in the final chapter. For now, let's look briefly at the hallucination theory. Most who argue that Jesus' earliest followers had hallucinations usually compare their experiences to the bereaved, those who experience an apparition of their dead loved one. New Testament scholar and atheist Gerd Ludemann has famously argued that Peter's guilt led him to project an apparition of Jesus so he could forgive him. Then afterward, Peter convinced many of the others of Jesus' resurrection. There are four main problems with this theory. For one, how does this explain the other appearances? It is doubtful that Peter could have convinced the others, like James or even the 500, that the crucified Jesus was alive again. This is especially true of the appearance to Paul. Paul wasn't looking for forgiveness from Jesus. He was looking to destroy Jesus' movement, including Peter. Second, Peter could have equally been enraged at Jesus for leading him and the others astray. He had left his wife, and possibly children, for over 3 years to follow this man. See Mark 10, 28 through 30. And now he was dead. Did he, like Paul, believe at this point that Jesus was cursed by God? How does Ludemann know that this was not Peter's state of mind after the crucifixion? If it was, Peter was not sad and looking for forgiveness. He was looking for revenge. Third, hallucinations were not unknown in the ancient world, and a hallucinatory experience of a ghost or apparition would not have led to the claim that Jesus had risen from the dead. Dale Allison rightly challenges this theory. Even if, however, we accept Ludemann's suppositions, we are still left with the question why a hallucination led a first century Jew to confess that Jesus had been raised from the dead. Last, why did the disciples of any of the other failed messianic movements not have hallucinations of their dead leader? Were they not also sad and lonely? Did they not also possess an imagination? We do not have a shred of evidence that any of them had hallucinations. Instead, the overwhelming evidence from these other movements suggests Jewish disciples were not the types to have hallucinations of a failed, dead messianic leader. Could Jesus' band of followers be the exception? Of course, but what is the evidence they were indeed hallucinating? Again, why would they have claimed Jesus was raised from the dead? Why would hallucinations or visions of Jesus lead to this threefold, unparalleled innovation among his earliest Jewish followers? Hallucinations and visions of Jesus may have convinced his followers that he had been exalted to heaven like Elijah and had gained eternal life like the Maccabean martyrs, but it defies all the evidence to suggest this would have led to the unique claim that he was raised on the third day. As Wright notes well, indeed, such visions meant precisely, as people in the ancient and modern worlds have discovered, that the person was dead, not that they were alive. If Jesus' resurrection appearances were hallucinations, particularly like the well-documented hallucinations of the bereaved, then they were unlike any hallucinations we have on record. The authors of the Gospels are at least aware of apparitions or ghosts appearing to loved ones and make clear this is not what happened in the case of Jesus. "See my hands and my feet, that it is I myself. touch me and see, for a spirit does not have flesh and bones, as you see that I have. And when he had said this, he showed them his hands and his feet. While he still could not believe it because of their joy and amazement, he said to them, "Have you anything here to eat?" They gave him a piece of broiled fish, and he took it and ate it before them. Luke 24:39-43. In his book, Resurrecting Jesus, Dale Allison surveys the scientific studies and literature on hallucinations and finds that four things do not happen or very rarely happen in the case of hallucination or hallucinations of a dead loved one. Hallucinations are rarely, if ever, experienced numerous times by both individuals and groups over an extended amount of time. Hallucinations of apparitions are not usually seen by large groups, as Jesus is seen by the 12 or even more than 500. Hallucinations have never led to the claim that a dead person has been resurrected. Hallucinations do not involve the person's enemy. All of these almost unheard-of phenomena in the literature on hallucinations happened in the case of the resurrection appearances of Jesus. Allison summarizes, "These appear to be the facts, and they raise the question of how we should explain them. The apologists for the faith say that the sightings of Jesus must, given the reports, have been objective. One person can hallucinate, but 12 at the same time? And dozens over an extended period of time? These are legitimate questions, and waving the magical wand of mass hysteria will not make them vanish." One possible exception to the first two of Allison's claims above is that Mary, the mother of Jesus, is said to have appeared to individuals and large crowds over the past 500 years. However, it should be pointed out that the first Marian apparition on record in 1531 was to one person, Juan Diego. And the more one looks at the evidence for this claim, the more questionable it becomes. For one, there's no written evidence of this appearance until over 100 years after the event. Second, Archbishop Juan de Zumarraga was said to be a part of the event, but in his prolific writings, he never mentions it. Third, this is nothing like the evidence we have for Jesus' appearances. We have bedrock documentation of multiple individuals and groups seeing the risen Jesus within a decade of the event, and all the appearances of Jesus were over a span of no more than 2 years. Finally, and most importantly, Marian appearances lack the innovation and unexpectedness of Jesus' resurrection appearances. There are many examples of Christians throughout church history claiming to have visions or dreams of saints and angels. It is not surprising, then, that eventually some Christians would claim Mary, the mother of Jesus, appeared to them. In the case of Mary or other saints, we can see why Christians over the millennia would expect them to appear to them. In contrast, after Jesus' crucifixion, there was no expectation of Jesus appearing to anyone. Wright explains, "Nobody was expecting this kind of thing. No kind of conversion experience would have generated such ideas. Nobody would have invented it, no matter how guilty or how forgiven they felt. No matter how many hours they pored over the scriptures. To suggest otherwise is to stop doing history and to enter into a fantasy world of our own." If Jesus' followers had hallucinations, they were unlike any type of hallucinations we have on record. The resurrection appearances of Jesus and what resulted from them, for instance, the founding of the largest religion in the world, are truly without analogy. They were completely unexpected. In a word, Jesus' resurrection appearances are unique. That's the end of this week's reading of Dr. Justin Bass's book, The Bedrock of Christianity. Be sure to check out the show notes for links to Dr. Bass's website, as well as this week's cigar. Also in the show notes are links to Treats and Truth Ministry, where you can get involved in helping to spread the gospel to and be a blessing to the homeless. Groundworks Ministries for daily Bible studies and devotionals. And the Burning Bush merchandise store, where you can pick up some items to help spread the word about the show. And I'd appreciate it if you would tell your friends. So until next week, have a great day, have a great cigar, and God bless.